All right, we are back. And you know, Mr. McMillan, one source of information we have not relied on much recently is some of the good work they're doing over at the Lincoln Project.
They do a lot of good work.
So let's do a minute-long clip from them. The title of it was Axis of Influence.
They came to America not to be American, but to change what America meant. They carry with them agendas that undermine our way of life and our culture. They take American jobs and take over American companies, broadcast propaganda and endanger our sovereignty, poisoning democracy. Who are they? Peter Thiel, Elon Musk, Rupert Murdoch. They are the new axis of evil, and they are here to help anyone but themselves. His running mate? Their guy.
I believe that we actually do have a threat to democracy in this country, but it is the threat of censorship.
His agenda? Their agenda.
The United States will be the crypto capital of the planet and the world.
His mouth? Their words.
He says, you're not going to be a dictator, are you? I said, no, other than day one.
They're even using Trump to scare Americans into claiming immigrants are dangerous. In their case, they're right.
And for the record, those foreigners slash immigrants that the Lincoln Project was concerned about were Peter Thiel from Germany, Elon Musk from South Africa, and Rupert Murdoch, formerly of Australia. You know, I have to admit, I've been following the progress of Rupert Murdoch for many decades now. I was first impressed when I went to Australia back in the 1980s to discover that there was at least one country out there that had newspapers worse than the United States. Who would have imagined that he would have become the kingmaker that he has evolved into? Within that little blurb you heard, Donald Trump mentions crypto in a favorable way. And this opens up a look at a wonderful article from The New Yorker, October 14th, 2024, issue article by Charles Duhigg, looking at Silicon Valley's influence game. This is going to be a deep dive worth many minutes. We've been very critical on this program over the years at the undue amount of power that has been gathered up by the people in Silicon Valley, the CEOs of Silicon Valley. Should I say the billionaire CEOs of Silicon Valley? While Silicon Valley retains this image of being a bastion of progressivism and liberalism, the fact of the matter is, when you factor in the actions of these billionaire CEOs, well, Silicon Valley can be seen as anything but progressive and liberal. I mean, we've talked about on the show, Brad Parscale used Facebook to help get Trump elected in 2016. This, I think it's fair to say, was not a blow for progressive politics. Mr. Millen points out, in fairness, that Facebook did offer the same tools to the Clinton camp, and they disdained them because they thought they had this tech thing dialed in. At any rate, to quote from the article by Charles Duhigg, one morning in February, Katie Porter was sitting in bed, futzing around her computer, when she learned that she was the target of a vast techno-political conspiracy. For the past 5 years, Porter had served in the House of Representatives on behalf of Orange County, California. She'd become famous, at least C-SPAN and MSNBC famous, for her evisceration of business tycoons, often aided by a whiteboard that she used to make camera-friendly presentations about corporate greed. Now she was in a highly competitive race to replace the California Senator Dianne Feinstein, who had died a few months earlier. The primary was in 3 weeks. A text from a campaign staffer popped up on Porter's screen. The staffer had just learned that a group named Fairshake was buying airtime in order to mount a last-minute blitz to oppose her candidacy. Indeed, the group was planning to spend roughly $10 million. Porter was bewildered. She had raised $30 million to bankroll her entire campaign, and that had taken years. The idea that some unknown group would swoop in and spend a fortune attacking her, she told me, seemed ludicrous. I was like, what the heck is Fairshake? Porter did some frantic Googling and discovered that Fairshake was a super PAC funded primarily by three tech firms involved in the cryptocurrency industry. In the House, Porter had been loosely affiliated with Senator Elizabeth Warren, an outspoken advocate of financial regulation, and with the progressive ring of the Democratic Party. But Porter hadn't been particularly vocal about cryptocurrency. She hadn't taken much of a position on the industry one way or the other. As she continued investigating Fairshake, she found that her neutrality didn't matter. A website politically aligned with Fairshake had deemed her very anti-crypto, though the evidence offered for this verdict was factually incorrect. The site claimed that she had opposed a pro-crypto bill in the House. In fact, she wasn't on the committee and hadn't voted at all. Soon afterwards, Fairshake began attack ads on TV. They didn't mention cryptocurrency or anything tech-related. Rather, they called Porter, quote, a bully and a liar, and falsely implied that she'd recently accepted campaign contributions from major pharmaceutical and oil companies. Nothing in the ads disclosed Fairshake's affiliation with Silicon Valley, its support of cryptocurrency, or its larger political aims. The negative campaign had a palpable effect. Porter, who initially polled well, lost decisively in the primary, coming in third with just 15% of the vote. But according to a person familiar with Fairshake, the Super PAC's intent wasn't simply to damage her. The group's backers didn't care at all much about Porter. Rather, the person familiar with Fairshake said, the goal of the attack campaign was to terrify other politicians, to warn anyone running for office that if you're anti-crypto, the industry will come after you. Skipping ahead, after Porter's defeat, it became obvious that the Super PAC's message had been received by politicians elsewhere. Candidates in New York, Arizona, Maryland, and Michigan began releasing crypto-friendly public statements and voting for pro-crypto bills. When Porter tried to explain to her three children why she had lost, part of the lesson focused on the real politic of wealth and elections. When you have members who are afraid of $10 million being spent overnight against them, the will in Washington to do what's right disappears pretty quickly, she recalls saying. This was naked political power designed to influence votes in Washington, and it worked. And now we get into the meat of the matter. Says Charles Duhigg, Porter's defeat, in fact, was the culmination of a strategy that had begun more than a decade earlier to turn Silicon Valley into the most powerful political operation in the nation. As the tech industry had become the planet's dominant economic force, a coterie of specialists, led in part by the political operatives who introduced the idea of, quote, a vast right-wing conspiracy, unquote, decades ago, have taught Silicon Valley how to play the game of politics. Their aim is to help tech leaders become as powerful in Washington, D.C., and in state legislatures as they are on Wall Street. Skipping ahead. Now, you remember that term, vast right-wing conspiracy, from the Clinton era. That term was concocted by a Chris Lehane. He was just shy of 30 years old when he came up with that notion to explain Republican efforts to undermine Bill and Hillary Clinton. It was such an inspired bit of showmanship that Hillary Clinton adopted it as one of her signature lines. At the time, Lehane was a lawyer in the Clinton White House tasked with defending the administration from charges of scandal. But he specialized in seizing control of the political conversation, finding colorful ways to put Republicans on defense. And boy, the Harris camp could sure use him right about now, but I don't want to digress. Lehane would go on to serve Al Gore's presidential campaign as press secretary. And after Gore's defeat, he set up shop in San Francisco. He'd worked in the Telecommunications Act of 1996 and was convinced that Silicon Valley was the future. He quickly built a business providing his dark arts to wealthy Californians. And I must say, Lehane is a bit of a Roger Stone on the left. Judging by this article, it notes that people started hiring him. When trial lawyers wanted to increase the state's caps on medical malpractice jury awards, they brought in Lehane, who helped send voter flyers that looked like cadaver toe tags. They also produced ads implying that doctors might be performing surgery while drunk. A few years later, when a prominent environmentalist hired Lehane to campaign against the Keystone XL pipeline, Lehane sent activists into press conferences carrying vials of sludge from an oil spill. It was so obnoxious that reporters fled the room. He then hired one of the Navy SEALs who had helped kill Osama bin Laden to talk to journalists and explain that if the pipeline were approved, a terrorist attack could flood Nebraska with one of the largest oil spills in American history. Lehane explained to a reporter his theory of civil discourse. Everyone has a game plan until you punch them in the mouth. So, let's punch them in the mouth. Charles Duhigg goes on to note that Lehane's efforts generally failed to impress the tech industry. For decades, Silicon Valley firms had considered themselves mostly detached from electoral politics. As one senior tech executive explained to the author, until about the mid-2010s, if you were a VC or a CEO, you might hire lobbyists to talk to politicians or gossip with you. But beyond that, most of the Valley thought politics was stupid. Within a decade of Lehane's move out west, however, a new kind of tech company was emerging. The so-called sharing economy firms like Uber, Airbnb, and TaskRabbit. These companies were disrupting long-established sectors, including transportation, hospitality, and contract labor. And skipping ahead, note that the punchline of this was that Silicon Valley thought that not understanding politics became an existential risk. There's a general realization that they had to get involved in politics whether they wanted to or not. At least that's what an executive said. I think they wanted to, personally. 2015, San Francisco. The city becomes the site of a major regulation battle in the form of Prop F, a ballot initiative to limit short-term housing rentals, which both sides acknowledged was an attack on Airbnb. The proposal had emerged from built-up frustration. Some San Franciscans complained that many buildings had essentially become unlicensed hotels, hosting hard-partying tourists who never turned off the music, didn't clean up their trash, and most worrying for city leaders, hadn't paid the taxes the city would have collected if they stayed at a Marriott. Other residents argued that Airbnb's presence was making it harder to find affordable housing because it was more profitable to rent to short-term visitors than to long-term tenants. Proposition F would essentially make it impossible for Airbnb to work with many homeowners for more than a few weeks a year. Early polling indicated the initiative was popular. Numerous other cities had been considering similar legislation and were eagerly watching to see what happened in San Francisco. What happened was that Airbnb's executives panicked. They called Lehane. He showed up and gave them a commanding speech. "You're looking at this all wrong," he said. "Prop F wasn't a crisis. It was an opportunity to change San Francisco's political landscape, to upend a narrative." The key, he told executives, was to build a campaign against Prop F as sophisticated as Barack Obama's recent presidential run, and to deploy insane amounts of money as a warning to politicians that an Airbnb voter, in quotes, existed and ought not to be crossed. He proposed a three-pronged strategy and explained to executives what politicians care about most is re-election. If the company could show that being anti-Airbnb would make it harder for them to stay in office, they would fall in line. Lehane was soon named Airbnb's head of global policy and public affairs. All right, the article goes on to describe how his first step was to reach out to the homeowners who were profiting by renting out their properties and to visitors who had avoided pricey hotel rooms. Lehane gathered up several former Obama campaign staffers to lead teams who made tens of thousands of phone calls to Airbnb hosts and renters, warning them about Prop F. The team members also urged hosts to attend town hall meetings, talk to neighbors, and call local officials. And they encouraged people to contact the California legislature, which was soon inundated with messages from around the world. Second part of the strategy, use large amounts of money to pressure San Francisco politicians. The company brought on hundreds of canvassers to knock on doors of 285,000 people, roughly a third of the city's population, and urge them to contact their local elected officials to say that opposing Airbnb was the equivalent of attacking innovation, economic independence, and American ideals. Yes, that's right. It's attacking truth, justice, and the American way. The relentless campaign posed a clear threat to the city's Board of Supervisors. If an official supported Prop F, Airbnb might encourage someone to run against him or her. "We said the quiet part out loud," a campaign staffer said. The goal was intimidation. Let everyone know that if they screw with us, they'll regret it. In all, Airbnb spent $8 million on the campaign, roughly 10 times as much as all the Prop F supporters combined. "It was the most ridiculous campaign I ever worked on," the staffer told me. "It was so over the top, so extreme. You shouldn't be able to spend that much money in a municipal election." That said, the staffer loved her time at Airbnb. "It was the most money I'd ever earned working in politics." Yes, the ethics of Silicon Valley. The third aspect of Lehane's strategy, says the article, was upending the debate over Prop F by proposing alternative solutions. Otherwise, Lehane and Airbnb's chief executive Brian Chesky believed the company would face similar proposals in other cities. "You can't just be against everything," Lehane told the Airbnb board. "You got to be for something. As a compromise, Airbnb had voluntarily begun paying taxes on short-term stays within the city. It also offered to share some internal company data, such as the number of guests visiting the city each month, which would help local officials monitor the service's impact on the community. What's more, Airbnb eventually offered to build a web interface that San Francisco officials could use to register hosts and track rental partners. The solution was self-serving in that it made the city dependent on Airbnb for monitoring Airbnb's activities. At any rate, this did guarantee San Francisco tens of millions of dollars annually. What do you know? When Prop F finally came to a vote, it was resoundingly defeated. So it was, the article points out, that the people in Silicon Valley realized that the ROI, the return on investment on politics, was better than anyone suspected. The author notes that voters respond only to enticements that they find persuasive, but companies like Airbnb, Lehane understood, could make arguments faster and more efficiently than nearly any political party or other special interest group, and this was a source of considerable power. The platforms are really the only ones who can speak to everyone now, Lehane said. Anyway, this is a long article, a good article. I recommend it very highly. I don't think we have time to go into all of it today, but I do want to note that embedded in this piece is an understanding of why it is that Donald Trump was speaking well of cryptocurrencies. Because believe you me, the crypto people have discovered that this is how they want to play the game. If you don't believe me, just ask Katie Porter. And what do you know? With J.D. Vance, himself a VC from Silicon Valley, venture capitalist, a man promoted by Peter Thiel to become the vice presidential nominee. Well, Vance is apparently pretty pro-crypto. And so is his boss, Donald J. Trump. Coincidence? Now, it should be noted, not coincidentally, that in July, Mark Andreessen and Ben Horowitz of the Andreessen Horowitz Venture Fund made a 90-minute video accusing President Biden of weakening America. Horowitz said they basically subverted the rule of law to attack the crypto industry. The two men were so concerned, they said they had no choice but to endorse Donald Trump in 2024. The article notes that they also noted that under Biden, billionaires like themselves might have to pay more taxes, but that issue received very little airtime. Anyway, the word apparently got pretty clearly to the Republicans on this issue. In Nashville, in July, there was an annual conference for Bitcoin enthusiasts and other cryptocurrency people. The star attraction? Donald Trump. The article notes that the event's appearance on the presidential campaign circuit and Trump's willingness to spend one of his campaign days in the state he's guaranteed to win confirmed that the crypto campaign initiated by Lehane was having an effect. The piece does note that Trump's embrace of crypto was a 180-degree turn. I know that's a shock to people familiar with Donald Trump. But as president, he said he's not a fan of cryptocurrencies, which are not money and can facilitate unlawful behavior, including drug trade and other illegal activity. To which he added, we have only one real currency in the USA. It's called the United States dollar. But what do you know? When the crypto people decided to endorse him and throw money at him, he changed his mind. Anyway, near the end, the article notes that what is certain is that Silicon Valley will continue to bully and woo politicians by deploying money and its giant user base as a lure and a weapon. And to this article, I'd like to tack on a poll conducted by the East Bay News Group. A poll taken in Silicon Valley, article by Ethan Barron, took a look at the results. And what do you know? In Silicon Valley, they find that 7 in 10 residents say the region's quality of life is getting worse. And they noted that the tech industry is widely mistrusted, with hefty majorities of respondents believing major Silicon Valley companies wield too much power, are largely responsible for the region's sky-high costs of housing, and have lost their ability to tell right from wrong. Additionally, Silicon Valley's next big thing, artificial intelligence, is broadly viewed with concern and skepticism. Apparently, one respondent of the poll said that most big tech firms are helmed by oligarchs who created tremendous wealth for themselves, noting that if uber-rich tech leaders contributed more to their communities where they're operating, public sentiment might improve. And the article notes near the end that major tech companies face overwhelming pressure from shareholders, quote, to make money at the expense of absolutely everything. And that certainly is an issue, isn't it? Anyway, the article in the New Yorker gives no hint that Silicon Valley, at least the cryptocurrency elements of Silicon Valley, are financing are making significant contributions to the Trump campaign. But, gee, don't you think that's quite possible?
Well, with crypto, you'd never know.
At any rate, we've decided on this particular program that we're going to lay off the Dave Pakman and Ben Mycelis and Brian Tyler Cohn, because we've been hitting them pretty hard. And, unfortunately, the segments Ms. Miller and I were looking at as potential candidates to come on this show were sort of, well, I'd say a universal downer. They were based on the fact that poll data, as we go to our analysis, shows that the 5-point lead that Kamala Harris had over Trump a month ago has apparently vanished, and they're calling the election a dead heat right now. How this is happening, I just have a hard time comprehending. As we just talked about with Mark Mattingly, my high school poli-sci teacher, Trump killed hundreds of thousands of Americans through his mismanagement of COVID. He has taken away the legal right to get an abortion by women in this country through his Supreme Court appointments. He openly called for and led a riot in the United States Capitol in effort to keep him in power. And yet, only one of the four trials that he was involved with has been completed, probably the least important of the four, but it did result in 34 felony convictions. Trump judges like Eileen Cannon have and the Supreme Court of the United States have paved a way for him to avoid the consequences of his actions, or at least make it harder to call him to account. So he's not in an orange jumpsuit, and he's not behind bars, even though, well, he should be. And as mentioned, there's roughly a 50-50 chance, as it stands right now, that he's going to become the 47th president of the United States. And if that happens, dear listener, I don't know what we're going to do on these programs in November, except, I don't know, provide advice as to what all of us might have to do. And again, the mainstream media, I watch these Trump rallies and the crazy things he's doing, and you see the coverage it gets, and it's just, they are sane-washing. They're not calling him out for his decline of mental functioning. I mean, admittedly, it's hard when you have a pathological liar to separate out what is a mental decline from just mendacity. But actually, it's not that hard. If you take a look at what he's been saying and doing lately, it's not that hard. If your Uncle Fred was saying and doing the things that Donald Trump is doing, well, you'd take him down to the doctor to get a mental status exam. You just would. And by the way, I guess we haven't mentioned lately that Donald Trump was convicted of sexual assault. That might be worth another round at the Lincoln Project, Mr. McMillan.
Sure.
We know Trump's history with women. How he sees them, how he treats them, how he insults and abuses them. We know his record. We know from his own bragging.
You can do anything, whatever you grab by the...
And we know from a court ruling that Trump is a sexual abuser who had to pay almost $100 million for defaming his victim.
I'm here because Donald Trump raped me.
Now, we're seeing his hatred for one woman, Vice President Kamala Harris. The attacks, ugly.
I didn't know she was black until a number of years ago when she happened to turn black. She became a black person.
The smears and lies, pure Trump.
She's sort of incompetent. She's not very smart, but she's very radical.
We know Donald Trump is desperate. We know he'll do anything to win. We know he'll do anything to beat a woman.
I suppose the one positive aspect of these polls that show that this is a horse race will hopefully galvanize the Democrats and those who are going to be Democrats on Election Day to realize that there's a lot of work to be done, the sleeves need to get rolled up, and when all these legal challenges come about, they need to be taken on one by one. On next week's program, we're going to speak with Stephen Harper, who has explained in a piece on Common Dreams that the election interference has already begun. We just have to be ready for it. There's been a lot of talk about an October surprise, a term that came about back in 1980 when the Republicans, particularly Bill Casey and George Herbert Walker Bush, cut a deal with the Iranian governments to keep our American hostages in Iran until Ronald Reagan could get elected president. The fear was that the return of the hostages could give Carter a boost and have him win the election. Well, that certainly didn't happen. There's been a lot of talk of how the court in New York, this is the U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan, has pretty much put the case back on the rails after the Supreme Court said, well, the president has immunity from official acts, to point out that an awful lot of what was done on January 6th was not an official act. And it is quite incredible that here we are in October of 2024, and this thing has gone around and around based on some ridiculous pleadings by the Trump people, the Trump attorneys back in spring, that got an ear at the Supreme Court. But what I can't figure out is why this isn't a bigger deal. I'm sure that Stephen Harper will have an opinion to offer on that on next week's program. Now, as we wrap this up, we do want to note that the New York Times article, I believe it's the New York Times article we were mocking a week ago, did manage to come up with the following evaluations of Donald Trump's actions out on the campaign stump. The Times noted that Donald Trump's rally speeches, in which the 78-year-old often rambles and roams from thought to thought, now last an average of 82 minutes, up from 45 minutes in 2016. He uses 32% more negative words than positive words, up from 21% when he first ran, and uses swear words 69% more often. Mr. Whelan points out, if you saw that last rally in Pennsylvania, he's dancing quite a bit more than he did before as well. Here's the punchline. The Times notes that experts say those shifts could reflect cognitive changes that often accompany advancing age. Man, that is sugarcoating it, isn't it? That is sane washing, isn't it? 69% more swear words. Take a look at the lunacy of the things he's talking about and how he can't remember what he just said. And that's all I'm going to say. This program was produced by Edward McMillan, who, to make up for Donald Trump, has vowed to use 70% fewer swear words in the near future.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Oh my. I think we will close with two quick quotes. One from Yogi Berra, who pointed out, it ain't over till it's over. And one from former Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev, who once said, the only problem with free elections is that you never know who's going to win them. I'm Douglas Everett. This has been Radio Parallax. Our thanks to Mark Mattingly, who taught me a lot of poli-sci many years ago, and we'll be back. And I do want to note in closing yet again that Stephen Harper will be back with us next week. We'll see you then. And Guy, thanks for keeping this thing going.